This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Charles Wininger has been a psychotherapist and a psychonaut, a user of psychoactive substances ranging from LSD to marijuana to psilocybin for decades. In his new memoir and practical guide, Listening to Ecstasy, The Transformative Power of MDMA, the 71-year-old New Yorker comes out of the chemical closet to talk about how MDMA has helped to revitalize his personal and professional life, what important lessons today's psychedelic renaissance has learned from the 1960s counterculture, and why serious fun that leads to both self-actualization and the revitalization of community is within our grasp. As MDMA-assisted therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder enters phase 3 trials for FDA approval and voters around the country legalize or decriminalize the use of psychedelics, Wininger believes that the time has come to have honest discussions of how best to use what the government calls illicit drugs to create a better world. One way we make that happen, he tells me, is for those of us who can do so and who dare to do so to come out of the chemical closet and say, I'm a user of these compounds. They do me a lot of good, and they help me function in a better way. They help me become more creative, more alive, and more useful to society as a whole. Here is The Reason Interview with Charles Wininger. Charles Wininger, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So let's start with the elevator pitch of the book, Listening to Ecstasy, The Transformative Power of MDMA. You're riding an elevator with somebody and they say, hey, I heard you just wrote a book. What's it about?
Listening to Ecstasy is a love story and an adventure story about how two people, my wife and I, entered a forbidden world of psychedelic drug users and found that world to be enchanted, and how it opened our lives to friendship, fun, and freedom.
Wow. Now, Reason is a libertarian publication. We've been around since 1968. In the very first sentence, possibly in the very first paragraph of our first issue, we were talking about legalizing drugs and recognizing drugs as another technology that can allow people to flourish. But you are you're a therapist. You're licensed by a medical establishment. Just very briefly, how scary is it for you to kind of come out openly and say, you know, you are in love with this molecule, which is technically illegal?
It is illegal, and it does take some courage for me and others to be coming out of the chemical closet. And the writing the book, the process of doing so over the past 7 years, has been a process of mobilizing my courage. But it was really simply an act of being fed up with hiding, that distance between who I really am and what I present in the world. I couldn't bear it anymore to have a difference between the one and the other. So wow. I needed to be.
So at the ripe old age, or the ripe young age, really, of 70, you have published this book. Could you describe the history of MDMA? And then explain what it is for people who may not be that familiar with it. And then let's talk about your first encounter with it.
Sure.
But what's the history of MDMA?
Okay. And you're speaking to a 71-year-old.
Ah, okay.
Well, it was discovered by Merck in 1912 and essentially put on the shelf until Sasha Shulgin, a renegade chemist in California in the 1970s, rediscovered it and started offering it to people in his little clan and also to people who were psychotherapists in Northern California, who instantly saw its potential for use with their individuals and their couples. As a matter of fact, the first name that these therapists gave the drug was empathy. But then it migrated to Dallas in the 80s, and the club scene there, where people saw that this very versatile chemical can be used for dancing the night away. And that's where it took on the word, the name of ecstasy. And we didn't know at the time about some of the dangers and about how if you didn't hydrate sufficiently, you could get into trouble with this compounds. So some people ended up in the ER, and some enterprising politicians lobbied the government to make it illegal. And so it's been illegal since 1985.
Could you talk about the basic, you've touched on them. One, what you get when you take ecstasy, or what you feel. On the one hand, there is this rich empathy and kind of feeling of unity with people, vulnerability. And then there's also, this kind of ability to join a kind of hive mind. What are the characteristics of taking ecstasy?
Well, it is essentially a very versatile chemical. So the same dosage, about 120 milligrams of MDMA, can be used in clinical trials, which they're using it now to treat PTSD. That same stash and that same dosage can be used to reclaim the lost heart of your relationship with your partner. And it can also be used to dance the night away with 1,000 others in wild abandon. I don't really know of another compound that is so versatile.
And you can also see how that would scare the living hell out of regulators, right? Or authorities of all sort. Either you have people kind of by themselves exploring their feelings or exploring their couples, or a rave, and nobody feels comfortable when 1,000 young people or 1,000 people of all ages are dancing the night away, do they?
No, they don't, because it really is an expression of complete freedom, which is, in my opinion, the American ideal. And those in authority and forces of control are just viscerally threatened by this.
Wow. When did you first take ecstasy?
Well, it was in the 1990s, and I didn't know at the time about the protocol. Got sick afterwards, actually. Developed a bad cold, headaches, and this sort of thing. I didn't know about how to adequately hydrate. And other tools that I now have in my book, there's a guide to safe use. We've learned so much over the years. But then in 2000, I met my second wife, and she was out of a bad marriage, a repressive marriage, and she wanted to spread her wings and fly. And she learned that I was a psychonaut, one who does psychedelics, and wanted to try MDMA. So I learned more about it and turned her on to it, and in so doing, got returned on to it myself. And this book is largely a story about our story and how we discovered a Hulk, and we discovered how this MDMA can really be used as a mirror of intimacy and closeness for us.
Right. You mentioned that MDMA is going to become legal in around 2023. The timeline is not quite set in stone, but could you talk about what's going on now that is going to lead to a reclaimed legal status for the drug?
Rick Doblin and MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, is now in phase three of their clinical trials, treating war veterans and survivors of sexual violence with intractable cases of PTSD with MDMA interspersed with sober therapy sessions. And they are finding that after 2 or 3 MDMA sessions, these people who couldn't, who could barely function, who weren't responding to any normal therapy or antidepressants, these people were no longer meeting the qualifications for PTSD. And because of this, the FDA is fast-tracking this, and it's en route to becoming a prescription medication in 2023.
Are you, I guess, let's talk about psychedelics, broadly speaking. And, you know, among, you know, I guess there's some question as to whether or not ecstasy or MDMA qualifies as a psychedelic. I really am not interested in getting into a kind of super pedantic and possibly hyper accurate discussion of what counts as a psychedelic or not. But to talk about kind of psychedelics generally, part of what makes your book so fascinating is it's part memoir, it's part how to, and it's also, you know, a scholarly dive into the literature about ecstasy. Can you talk about the use of psychedelics and the way that intersected with your life, kind of starting in the 60s? You're 71. You are a baby boomer. You are in many ways representative of an entire generation that grew up after World War II in relative luxury and in dealing with psychological issues in a kind of forthright way using chemicals. But could you kind of sketch a quick history, and I apologize for asking you to do this, but a quick history of psychedelic drugs from, you know, the 60s through the current moment.
The psychedelic drug of the 1960s was really LSD, infamously, with Tim Leary being at the forefront of this. And I love, Nick, that they called LSD, we called it acid, because it really helped burn a hole through the legitimacy of authoritarianism. We would drop acid and trip, and we'd have hallucinations, and we'd have all sorts of insights, including insights about the power structure in this country that was drafting us and sending us off to a terrible war. And more than just simply realizing that this was an illegitimate power structure, we also realized that it was absurd. It was ridiculous. And so we did something to them that freaked them out. We laughed at them. We saw that they were just absurd. And this was, for me personally, a very central part of my 1960s experience with psychedelics, including mushrooms and mescaline as well. So what we didn't know in the 1960s that we learned afterwards is the importance of set and setting to a good psychedelic experience. And I do include MDMA as a psychedelic. So set being the mindset one has going in, and setting being your surroundings and how much in control you are of your surroundings. And these elements are crucial to having a positive experience. We didn't know too much about that in the 1960s, and that's why some people had what we called bad trips or bummers. They were really simply difficult experiences that needed to be integrated. But it gave LSD and other drugs a bad name at the time. So since then, we've learned, and that's why I have it in the book, the protocols, the guidelines for safe use to maximize the benefits and minimize the risks of these very powerful medicines.
Could you, how do you compare, and I'm interested in you, you know, how you conceptualize this. We're clearly going through some sort of psychedelic renaissance, or it might be a nascence. You know, it's the first time really where there's a full flourishing, a full flowering of a lot of interest and a lot of serious thought given to how psychedelics can help us self-actualize, become who we want to be, change ourselves and change society. What is driving that? And what are your, you know, how do you see it playing out? Are we in a good place? Are we in a bad place? What needs to happen?
We're in a very exciting renaissance of interest in these compounds. And the one of the dictums in the culture right now, sort of underground, is let's not fuck it up this time. Let's not stick it in the faces of the authorities in the way that they're going to clamp down again. Let's do it in a, quote, legitimate way this time, which is what MAPS and Rick Doblin are doing, opening the doors from a medical standpoint. So there is this resurgence of interest in psychedelics, and that's why the media reports these days have been all positive about people who have cured themselves or through the clinical trials or their own use of depression, of social anxiety, and other forms of anxiety. So it's all imbued now, this whole topic is imbued with a sense of optimism and hope. And that's thrilling for me, who've come out of the 60s explosion and then the repression that followed and now this renaissance. It's a little disorienting to have people be so open now about their use, but it inspired me to be open myself. And it's thrilling to be.
How are you dealing with the fact that in the book you write very movingly of growing up on Long Island in the 50s and 60s and talking about the death of your mother at when you were a young child, but then also the emotional distance with your father? I mean, and this is when I say it's very representative. It's, you know, you're telling a story that literally millions of people or tens of millions, possibly hundreds of millions of people can relate to. You know, now you're the old beard. You, how are you dealing with being in a position of being the elder, and what has changed?
What has changed? You mean what has changed since the time I was growing up as far as...
Yeah. And I guess how is you,
what do you mean?
Yeah, what is, you know, the generation gap in the 60s was, it had a lot to do with, you know, certainly things like the draft and denying women control over their bodies, you know, with sexual, with reproductive freedoms. And you talked about how, you know, the way that boomers responded to that authority was laughing at it, but in one way, making fun of it, mocking it, and just ignoring it as much as possible. Didn't work out so well. What is the nature of, you know, and there was a generation gap between parents who I think by and large couldn't understand why their kids didn't want to do what they told them to do. What's the nature of the generation gap now? And then how do psychedelics help close that gap or make it more productive?
To be honest, Nick, I don't see a generation gap being half as bad as it was back then. Then it was a unique function of a unique quality of and characteristic of the culture. The word generation gap, that phrase came from that time. And it was a unique way that the country was divided at the time. So I don't think it's as active a division now as it was then. And I noticed that as an elder in the psychedelic community, at least, I'm respected and looked up to. And that's a wonderful thing. And when Shelley...
So we're no longer in the era of, you know, don't trust anyone over 30. That was a historical moment. And we're in a different place now.
There is some animosity towards boomers by young people. That's where the phrase okay boomer came from in the past year. Like, you know, pipe down, we've heard enough from you guys. So there is some of that, because we boomers, you know, a lot has gone wrong on our watch in the past 50 years. So that's some of that's understandable. But I don't see families being split apart like they were in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Could you, you write at one point that MDMA helps keep you young. How does it do that?
Well, speaking for myself, it revitalizes me. It helps me because chemically what happens is one gets flooded with serotonin and oxytocin. And so there's this tremendous feeling of well-being and vitality. And I can dance the night away like I was 30 years old. which is an extraordinary experience here at 70, 71, and makes me realize that that's all really still available to me. And I don't have to be high on MDMA to reclaim that vitality that's not far beneath the surface. It reminds me and refreshes me. So it is a fountain of youth. At least it is for me and my wife and others that we know.
Yeah. You have been a therapist for how long now?
About 30 years.
Yeah. Over that period of time, do you... I guess before I ask you the next question, can you describe your general orientation in terms of therapy? You come out of a Gestalt tradition, but how do you define your practice? What are you bringing to?
Well, my specialty is communication skills. Half my practice is couples, and I'm working mostly from a Gestalt perspective, which focuses on the here and now. Nobody's on the couch. You know, lying down, talking about their early infantile behavior or their relationship with their mother, unless it comes up naturally in the moment. So it's basically here and now, I and thou. It's really about also the relationship between and what's going on in the moment between me and the client. And I prefer the term client to patient, because patient implies like I'm the healthy doctor and you're the sick patient. I don't feel comfortable with those kind of roles. We're two human beings together trying to work it out and trying to connect in an authentic way. And so I'm there listening deeply into what my client is saying and receiving them as best they can, and showing that I'm willing to be as vulnerable as they are and meet them in that place, which tends to help them feel safe and lower their defenses temporarily. So actually what I'm trying to do is replicate the MDMA experience in the therapy room. I'm not doing MDMA therapy. So I don't practice high, and my patients, my clients are not high, but I'm trying to replicate that experience of well-being and safety in the counseling room.
Do you, over the course of your practice, do you have the types of problems that are presented to you or that come up in therapy, have those changed in any kind of meaningful way or recognizable way?
Often it has been and remains essentially problems of relationship. And I guess they've exacerbated over the years where people are relating more to screens than other human beings face to face. And this is even pre-pandemic. So people are losing their abilities to connect in an authentic way with their romantic partner or with friends or family, and therefore feel split off from people, separate, alien, alone, lonely. That's why there is, it's one reason there is an epidemic of loneliness in this country, which leads to all sorts of problems. So I'm there to put him through a kind of communications rehab, where I help them get back in touch with themselves and the people who are important to them.
You don't do MDMA assisted therapy at this point. Do you plan to once it becomes legal?
Oh, I can't wait. It's going to be a wonderful thing. I could do 6 months of couples counseling in a day with MDMA.
You, at one point, you quote Viktor Frankl, the concentration camp survivor and a major figure in the human potential movement in the post-war years. And a lot of the work that you're doing, and certainly the tradition of psychedelics, is very indebted to the human potential movement. But you quote Frankl saying, "Man is not destroyed by suffering. He is destroyed by suffering without meaning." Does MDMA intersect with that insight in a meaningful or a powerful way?
It does for me. Meaning is a very important thing to me. Many people derive their meaning in life, many adults derive their meaning in life from having children having families. I don't have children. So it's been very important to find and instill or even impose meaning on my life. And so MDMA has helped me do that, mostly because there's a whole community here in New York that my wife and I associate with, that we share experiences with and we have friendships with. And this, that's why I call MDMA the chemical of connection. It connects one to oneself and to other people. It encourages, this medicine encourages you to reach out and figuratively or literally touch another person and deepen that connection. And that's been very meaningful to me.
So it's doing something that AT&T never could.
That's right.
Reach out and touch someone. Yeah. Do you feel like as a culture, are we more sophisticated or knowledgeable and responsible in our drug use than we were 30 years ago or 50 years ago?
Yes, in a word. We are learning that, slowly learning that there are bad drugs and there are good drugs, including now what is really challenging to the mainstream culture is that there are really good drugs that are still illegal. But the media and mainstream media is getting the word out that this is so. And that's something that is thrilling and something I never thought I'd live to see.
Yeah, what do you think explains that?
It took us 50 years to integrate the 1960s into our consciousness.
You're using integrate there in a very specific way. Could you talk a little bit about how you're using
it? In the psychedelic community, there's an emphasis on integrating psychedelic experiences. That is, learning to turn states into traits. Learning to turn the experience of, for example, a good MDMA high, to translate that into your life and bring it into your life in a sober way, because we spend most of our time, hopefully, sober. So I've been very much that's a part of where I derive meaning from the medicine. So it's taken this culture about half a century to integrate the what was for many in the culture a traumatic experience with these compounds, mostly traumatic by for those who were sober, as Timothy Leary famously said, LSD sparks paranoid reactions in those who have never taken it. So it's taken a long time for the culture to largely forget the polarization and violent polarization that happened in the 60s and early 70s, and have that generation gap reduced and have traumas like the Vietnam War become a memory, so that psychedelics can now reemerge in using the medical model as a healing force in a time when we need healing very much.
Do you, at times, and obviously you're a therapist, at times in the book you talk about the kind of medical use or a medical model of these drugs. Obviously, that is what ultimately mainstreamed marijuana into American culture, where first you had medical marijuana, now we have recreational marijuana, and overwhelmingly, most Americans live in a place where recreational marijuana is either legal or a short drive away. Do you have concerns about the medical model being the main way or the only way that certain types of drugs are able to be used?
I do, because one aspect of this culture and the Protestant work ethic of this culture, with all its advantages and disadvantages, is that we have downplayed fun, joy, and play as potentially not only useful, but potentially transformational experiences. And that's one thing that my book is about and my life is about. And so to use one person's phrase, these compounds can be used for the betterment of well people. And that's what is the real boon that's coming, I believe, as psychedelics become more mainstream and people realize that they don't have to be emotionally or physically ill to benefit from them, and that they can use it to restore the lost heart of their relationship, or they can use it to build upon a good relationship. They can use it to, we call it recreational use. I prefer the term celebrational use.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's when I first, you know, got a copy of your book, Listening to Ecstasy, the first thing that came to mind, I mean, obviously, it's a reference to listening to Prozac, a book that talked about the, you know, the popularity of and widespread use of SSRIs, which, you know, I think helped lay the groundwork for the, you know, the celebratory use of drugs, but also Timothy Leary's essay collection from the 60s, The Politics of Ecstasy. Dilate a little bit on why ecstasy, at least a little bit of ecstasy, is a good thing.
Because to reach that state of ecstasis, one is brought out of their normal day-to-day reality and brought, well, speaking for myself, the father of Gestalt therapy, Fritz Perls, famously said, lose your mind and come to your senses. So when I'm high on MDMA, my mind and all the thousands of thoughts that get generated by it throughout the day quiets down, and I come to my senses, and I feel my heart, and I feel my love. And I feel this sensual aliveness, this lift of aliveness in my being, this chemical affirmation of my spirit. And it's like the sun itself is rising in my heart. And I feel a joy and a feeling of being uplifted. And it's like taking a chemical helicopter ride above my life, and I can look out at where I've been, where I am in my life, and perhaps to the horizon where I want to go. And it gives me this sense of perspective that is priceless. And then I can come back down and rededicate myself to the way I want to be living.
Yeah. So. Your book in many ways, and it reminds me of my Reason colleague, Jacob Solomon, a few years ago, wrote a book called Saying Yes in Defense of Drug Use. And in that he talks about responsible drug use. And in many ways, your book is a kind of manual of responsible drug use. Could you walk through a little of the, you know, you've mentioned the protocols. What are the things that people should keep in mind if, in fact, they're interested in exploring ecstasy or psychedelics?
Especially as one ages, and I mean past the age of 35 or 40, that less can be more. The way to keep a happy long-term relationship with these wonderful medicines is to not abuse them, and which takes some discipline. Because the experience can be so good that you want to do it again and again. But I can't roll, which is the term you use to have an MDMA experience, today and then do it again tomorrow or even next week. I limit it to 4 or 5 times a year. That way I can keep it up into my 70s. And same with LSD or psilocybin. Moderate your frequency, moderate your dose, and also pay attention to set and setting, your mindset going in. Shelley and I, we're never sitting around on a Saturday night and saying, what do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? Well, let's roll. It's never like that. We always plan it ahead of time. The next time we're going to do it, New Year's Eve, for a celebrational purpose. or we'll plan an experience with friends or at a festival, music festival and the like. So we plan these things very carefully, and it gives us so much to look forward to in life at this stage of life.
Yeah. You, at one point in the book, you raise a rhetorical question, and I'd like your answer to it. You write, are drugs wasted on the young? Mm-hmm. Are they?
Are they wasted on the young or the wasted? Many young people, not all, do give good drugs bad name because they are using it to avoid and escape their problems, or using it to boast to their friends about how much they can do and how much they can abuse. So they give good drugs a bad name. But there are many young people in the psychedelic community who are very responsible in their use. And they know what they're doing, and they are helping promote the serious and therapeutic and recreational use of these compounds in a very positive way.
I guess as a final question, and I'd like your kind of response to it, and please be as free form as you would like to be. In reading, listening to Ecstasy, The Transformative Power of MDMA, I kept going back to the Bob Dylan song, My Back Pages, where the refrain is, we were so much older then, we're younger than that now. It seems to me that the argument that you're making, not simply about a particular drug or a molecule, but about American society in general, is that we have within our grasp a serious renewal of the promise. You talked about the anti-authority kind of dimension, ethos of America, and of individual fulfillment and of community action. Do you feel like we're living, My Back Pages at this point, or that we can?
We can. There is that hope. There is evidence of that now, which gives me great hope and optimism for our future. We seem to be headed in that direction, but we're also headed in other more dangerous directions. And it seems like a race between the forces of darkness and light in this culture and in our politics. I don't know which side is going to win, and it's fascinating to watch, but there is much reason to be hopeful at this stage.
Can I ask on a kind of overtly or a directly political question? Joe Biden, who is going to be president of the United States, is one of the architects of the war on drugs in general. He's been in the Senate since the early 70s. Specifically, he has been against ecstasy, against MDMA at various points. Do you feel hopeful that he will, that this will be a Nixon going to China with, pockets full of the best LSD imaginable? Or do you worry? And I guess in a larger sense, is it up to us as the people to kind of force the change rather than wait around for it to be granted to us by our leaders?
The latter, the last thing you just said. Yes, it's really up to us to make it happen, and we are making it happen by voting. As somebody said, drugs won the election. Everywhere there was decriminalization or legalization on the ballot, it won. So I am concerned about where the next administration is going to take things. I'm hopeful that they will go along with the liberalization of the use of these compounds. We'll have to see. But yes, it's up to people like you and I to make this happen. And one way we make it happen, Nick, is for those who can do so and who dare to do so, to come out of the chemical closet and say, I am a user of these compounds, and they do me a lot of good, and they help me function. They help me function in a better way. They help me become more creative, more alive, and more useful to society as a whole.
Well, there's a saying going around that, the drug war is over and the drugs won, to the extent that they are. I appreciate the role that you played in this, Charlie, and also the role that listening to ecstasy, the transformative power of MDMA, will play in kind of pushing us into the next stage of being better human. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it and appreciate the work that you're doing, Nick.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts. Thanks for listening.